Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
To another episode of Textree. Today we are time traveling back to 1938. We'll be reading a book called Fashion is Spinach, a book by Elizabeth Hawes, who was a designer and a critic of the fashion industry. Why is the book called like that? There is only a drawing at the beginning of the book where a mother is trying to feed her daughter and she says, "Eat your broccoli, dear." And the child says, "I say it's spinach and I say to hell with it." So that's the only piece of context that I found. It probably is explained somewhere in the book, but the book is 336 pages, so I didn't read all of it. However, I do believe it is an interesting book because Elizabeth was a fashion girly. She was a girl's girl. She was very much into fashion, very much into design. But at the same time, she did see everything that was wrong with fashion at the time. And fascinatingly enough, a lot of those things are still the same. Anyway, about Elizabeth first. She, at the end of her sophomore year, she went on a 6-week course at Parsons School of Fine and Applied Arts because she wanted to learn something that will make fashion design easier for her. But she was a little disappointed. She argued that an art school will never actually teach her fashion design. And she said it's all theory and no practice. They didn't even teach her basic anatomy. So a year later, she began an unpaid apprenticeship at the Bergdorf Goodman workrooms to sort of observe how things are made and to learn the making of expensive clothes. So the fun thing about Elizabeth is that she was very motivated and she had numerous plans. She knew she wants to do fashion design and she knew how she's going to achieve it. So her first plan was going to Paris to sort of experience the world of fashion firsthand. But not only she had to graduate college first, but she also needed the money, obviously, to go to Paris from the US. So she would sell her own designs to her classmates to raise funds for the trip, which I think is pretty cool because it was the early 20s. Not only did she raise enough money to go to Paris and she ended up going to Paris, but she also ended up going several times and she worked in the Paris fashion industry too. And her writing reflects what I would call two wolves. One wolf is a fashion girly because she clearly loves fashion. She's fascinated by fashion. And the other wolf is completely disenchanted with the fashion industry. The other wolf considers it fake and classist and honestly quite immoral. For example, the way she would make money at some point was she would attend Paris fashion shows like Chanel. She would memorize the dresses during the fashion show and she would later sketch the designs and she would sell those designs to the US and to the US brands. And then the designers from those brands would copy the designs like literally one to one. So she does sound a little harsh sometimes when she's talking about fashion. Let's have a look at this first excerpt. "Fashion is that horrid little man with an evil eye who tells you that your last winter's coat may be in perfect physical condition, but you can't wear it. You can't wear it because it has a belt, and this year we are not showing belts. Fashion gets up those perfectly ghastly ideas. such as accessories should match, and proceeds to give you shoes, gloves, bag, and hat all in the same hideous shade of Kelly Green, which he insists is chic this season, whether it turns you yellow or not. Fashion is apt to insist 1 year that you are nobody if you wear flat heels, and then turn right around and throw thousands of them in your face. Fashion persuades millions of women that comfort and good lines are not all they should ask in clothes. Fashion swings the female population this way, and that through the magic expression that they are wearing such and such this season, and you must do likewise or be ostracized. This is literally my problem with fashion personally. I feel like it has gotten slightly better. But still, the judgment that we give people that choose to not follow fashion, and the hypocrisy of fashion, the thing that she mentions with things being out of fashion one season and then very fashionable the next. I have noticed recently a trend where girls on Instagram are showing photos of their eyebrows from 2016. Obviously, that was a time where very strong, very blocky eyebrows were fashionable. And they're like, oh my God, what was I thinking? As they currently sport those thin, fashionable eyebrows. And I'm just thinking, I vividly remember people bullying thin eyebrows maybe like 10 years back. It's this hypocrisy that to me is one of the drawbacks of fashion, is that we do not keep a perspective of what was fashionable, and we do not treat current trends as temporary. Every time something shows out, we usually believe it's here to stay. This is the right way to look. That's exactly what she has a problem with. She also mentions something that I personally find so infuriating in modern fashion, which is whenever something is fashionable, it's literally the only thing you can find. So for years, I've been trying to look for shoes that I used to wear practically every day, but then there was a hole and I just couldn't wear them anymore. There is absolutely no way in hell I can find those shoes nowadays, because this type of shoe currently is sporting a very thick sole, and it has been like that for the past maybe 2-3 years, where every single shoe of this type has a very thick sole. So I don't know who decides this. I don't know what fashion committee decreed that I cannot buy flat-soled shoes anymore. But it's an example of once something is fashionable, there is practically no way you can get anything else. And this is what she's saying about this. I want a navy blue dress in the fall. It is only worn in the spring, the sales girl says. I want a coat with no fur trimming in the winter of 1930. All winter coats have fur trimming, the sales girl says. I want a plain knit bathing suit with a skirt. They're all fancy knits this year and they have no skirts. I want a brassiere and separate pants bathing suit. We don't have them anymore. That was last year. I can relate to this so much, because it's also one of the things I absolutely hate about modern bathing suits, is that they're always cut very high at the bottom, unlike vintage suits that covered most of your front body. So because they're not fashionable currently, there is practically no way to find those suits. And apparently that was already the case in the 30s. So she ended up working in the US for a while. And then in 1927, she finally came back to Paris and she was like, okay, this is serious. I'm going to work on my fashion designer career. Where is a better place to do it than Paris? So she describes what she was doing. She describes the whole process. She starts off with getting an offer from Vogue, but she was like, that's not what I'm trying to do. I want to be a designer. So the chapter is called Cutting, Pinning and Draping. It was April of 1928 when I was called to the Vogue office. With no hesitation at all, I declined the job. I told Monsieur Boucher that I had come to Paris to learn to design clothes, that I was ready to start. If I couldn't design clothes in Paris, I was going home to America. Monsieur Boucher was very sympathetic. Probably he was feeling the same way, since he very soon afterward started his own place and turned out to be a couturier himself. He said that if I was so bent on designing, he'd get me a job. He said he might be able to get me into Patou or Lanvin or Nicole Groult. The first two were among the famous. Nicole Groult, the sister of Poiret, had a little shop on a side street and did rather conservative, nice clothes. I decided I'd prefer Groult because she had such a small place that I might really be allowed to do some work. It seemed impossible to me that either Patou or Lanvin would ever let me cut up a piece of material. Nicole Groult was an eccentric-looking lady, about 5'5", with reddish hair and a face that had been painted by a good artist with a sense of humor. She was, I guess, about 40, and had had a very slim figure. She wore simple little silk dresses, with a belt tied in her natural waistline. This was the height of eccentricity, since nobody had worn their belts above their hips for several years. A reminder, this is 1928, so the flapper-style waistline was still pretty much a trend. Monsieur Boucher made an appointment for me to see Madame Groult. We talked a bit about nothing much, except that I was determined to design and had nothing whatever to show her. Very quickly she said, "Come on in. I like young people." I was hired for 500 francs a month, about $20, just what I'd gotten in my first Paris job. I told her I didn't want any salary, just to be allowed to make about 15 dresses without interference. She insisted on paying me something and I went to work. It was May, the latter part. She was just about to start on her new collection, which had to be finished for the buyers in July. That's quite late, isn't it? I mean, to be fair, fashion is always quite late. Like, people are always finishing up dresses right before they go on the runway. So maybe that was just the beginning of a really long tradition. I suppose she let me in because Mme Boucher must have told her I knew Americans in Paris. And also because I had worked for Macy's and Lord & Taylor, and the Maison Groult was not being very successful with Americans. The clientele was mostly French. The clothes really didn't have enough detail to attract manufacturers. I think some new money had just been put in by a gentleman who had hoped to build the house up. Every afternoon for the first couple of weeks, we looked at collections of materials. We were Madame Groult, George, her assistant designer, and myself. Every designer in Paris was busy doing the same thing. The salesmen from Rodier and Bianchini and Duchon and all the fabric manufacturers, large and small, came around with suitcases full of large samples. I always wondered how things like that worked, how the whole process of designing and making clothes worked back then, because obviously it was a much slower process and a process that was much more luxurious. So In case of this small fashion house in Paris, there would be fabric salesmen coming in and showing you the samples. We looked through all of them, and every time any of us liked anything, we checked it. That meant that a piece was sent in on a memorandum. This consummation, devoutly to be wished by every designer, does not as yet exist for the couturier in America. It means simply this: the fabric house sends you whatever material you like in hopes that you may make a dress out of it. You, the designer, have a large room which becomes filled with piles of every kind of stuff that pleases your fancy. You use whatever you like and return all the rest. If you are a big designer in Paris, Vionnet, Patou, Lanvin, you not only can select what you want, but you tell the fabric manufacturer ahead of time what material you are going to want. The manufacturer then makes it, and you use it or not, just as you please after you see it. It only shows how high the reputation of the most renowned fashion houses must have been. Vionnet in late 20s, early 30s was probably the hottest name. And it was so universally recognized that they could basically ask the manufacturers to make whatever they wanted and not even pay for it. I think that's what she's saying. Nicole Groult was not in a position to dictate to the fabric manufacturers. It didn't matter much to me or to her, I think. We selected hundreds of materials out of which we might make clothes. When we had seen the fabric salesmen, the trimming people flooded in. We selected all the buttons and belts and buckles we liked and got samples of them to have on hand. That sounds honestly like a dream job. Imagine you're in Paris in late 20s and you're shown all these gorgeous, beautiful designs and fabrics, and the manufacturers are just like, yeah, you can keep it, I guess. Nicole Gruhl never worked before 2:30. Neither did George. When we got to the designing, I used to go in the morning because nobody was around and I could have the materials and models and mirrors to myself. George worked entirely from sketches. He was a good sketcher, if not a particularly talented designer. He had rather theatrical ideas, which looked more exciting on paper than in the flesh. Madame Gruhl could neither sketch nor cut, as far as I was able to make out. She sometimes brought in very rough little pencil marks, which she explained to the fitter, who seemed to get her ideas and make up what she wanted. I think that's often the case when the designer is not particularly skilled at drawing. But it's interesting also that when I think rich people nowadays, rich people that work, I do imagine they are quite workaholic, whereas she's saying they came in after 2:30, they were just chilling, they didn't even draw. It sounds like a hobby more than a job. Often I think she simply selected a bolt of material and told the fitter what she wanted without either rough sketch or draping. Perhaps George sketched for her sometimes. All over Paris in the month of June, every dressmaking establishment was busy going through the same motions. I understand that Patou used to select his fabrics and tell the head of his workrooms what line he wanted in the clothes for the season. The fitters would then retire and make muslins. Patou looked over the muslins, changed them, gave exact material and color, supervised fittings, and you had a Patou collection. The fitter, the premier as she is called in France, is a most important person in any dressmaking establishment. Very often the French premier is the actual designer, as in the case of Patou. Patou stood, I think, in the place of a stylist, but a functioning one to his premiers. In Nicole Gruhl's, the premiers had to decide for themselves how to cut George's sketches and the ideas of Madame Gruhl. I worked every known way that season trying to find out how I best could develop my ideas. The method I afterward took to is that used by Vionnet. Vionnet has a half-sized wooden mannequin on which she cuts patterns. Her premiers then make full-sized patterns from the small ones. I don't know whether or not Vionnet sketches. Many designers work entirely from sketches, leaving the whole decision of the final cut to the premier. It is my belief that designers who work that way are limited by the imagination of the premier to such an extent that their designs often fail of complete fulfillment. It's interesting that she had insight to all those big brands and she was probably told the way they worked. So some of them actually sketched. Some of them just gave verbal information on the designs. Some of them made miniature versions of the designs. But at the end of the day, sometimes whatever they came up with did not really work with fabric or did not work in real life. There seems no reason why something as perfectly flat as a tailored suit should not be designed on paper. I do most tailored and sports clothes on paper. Also, if one knows cutting and is repeating and changing something already designed, it can be done on paper. But all new cuts, and I think really new lines, come out of the material. If a designer is blessed with a super premiere, all is well. If a designer is not so blessed, she herself had better know how to cut. There is, of course, still another method of designing. You take a bolt of material and a woman, and cut, pin, and drape her into a finished dress. My impression is that few professional designers use the method. It is the method which the public wishes to think designers use. That is true, because I think every single fashion designing scene that I've ever seen was a person playing with a mannequin or pinning something to a model. Few, if any, designers can afford to ruin yards and yards of expensive material. I mean, fair point. One must know before slashing into a bit of gold brocade at $20 a yard just how it is to be cut. To design by cutting on a person is the most wasteful thing in the world. Not once in a million does a dress come out exactly as planned in advance. Even when one cuts muslin patterns and corrects them before cutting in the material, there are changes which often necessitate throwing out half the dress. Also, inspirational draping usually leads to hacking up and cutting off the grain of the material. If material is not cut in accordance with the weave, it hangs in every direction and just won't go where you want it to. It pulls in here, hangs out there, and there is hell to pay. I actually do agree. I mean, draping is sometimes problematic, but I do think, especially with making a mock-up first, it's actually not that risky. Madame Groot, George, and myself used to assemble about 3 every afternoon so the premieres could bring in our newly cut dresses. Sometimes they looked swell, other times they looked awful. George and I decided that Nicole never puts any backs in her dresses. She thought up the outline and the front and forgot to discuss the back with the premiere. So usually the material just went around and covered up the nakedness under it. George and I took to attacking Madame Groot for having no backs. She was very pleasant about it all and paid very little attention. She tried to help us when we made something awful. Once I had 3 frights come out in a row. I probably looked as ill as I felt because she hastily told me to wait and see how I felt when I did 15 bad dresses at once. This is interesting because I never thought about the fact that sometimes the designs just don't look good. So they look good on paper, but then you make them and obviously lines of the drawing behave differently to lines of fabric. So some ideas might just not work in terms of proportions or how they look. The worst trouble George had was that he'd make very beautiful sketches on women 9 feet high. When the dress was cut in normal proportion, it was all chopped into little fiddling bits. I think, isn't that what most designers do? They always elongate the figure on the sketch, but then you look at it IRL and you're like, that's like half the length. And I always thought about it, about fashion plays from that era as well, because the women on drawings are very elongated, but then you see the actual dresses, you're like, oh, no, they're actually human beings. So it doesn't look as good as it did on the drawing sometimes. Madame Groot and I only had one set to. It was on the matter of the waistline. Madame Groot had a way of taking dresses which looked wrong off the mannequin and putting them on herself. Madame Groot, as I have indicated, had been very thin but was now acquiring a small tummy. Waistlines were by way of indicating a return to normal in 1928. Groot had not only always worn normal waistlines, but had shown them in her collection. Her figure was getting to the point where the normal waistline was not as becoming as it had once been. I like normal waistlines. I started to put them on my clothes. Madame Groot took to putting my normal waisted dresses on herself and lowering the waistline. I took exception to that. But Madame Groot, I argued, you have had normal waistlines for years. Why do you want to stop now when they are just about to come back into style? If everyone else is going to have them, why should I? She snapped. I'm sick of them. I think one of the things which determines the life of a dress designer is how much she designs for herself. If the designer cannot get objective about clothes, she is limited to a large extent in the duration of her success. Nicole Groot has always designed for herself and sold it to what public she had. That is such an interesting point. If the designer is not completely objective, they will just keep following around other designers' ideas. Because who dictates where the waistline is if not the designer? Schiaparelli has always, in my opinion, designed for herself. Vera Borea of short-lived fame designed for herself. Vionnet probably never designed for herself in her life. She is the exact opposite of the Vionnet model type. She is short and plumpish. I wouldn't be surprised if Chanel, when she had her great success, was designing for herself. Chanel was obviously too intelligent a woman to continue that too long. Her designs, however, have never had their first great integrity since long waists went out and femininity came in. I find it funny because we love saying that, oh, Chanel is not the classy thing that it used to be. But they've been already saying that in 1930s, which is now probably considered the peak of Chanel. If a designer designs for herself, she has as big a success as there are people who are built like her and who feel just as she does about clothes. The minute she loses her figure, her designs are lost to the young people growing up. She may retain an ever-aging clientele. Finally, they go other places in search of youth, or they die. Through 6 weeks of pain and pleasure, the collections of the French designers evolved, Nicole Groulx with the rest. The only reason those collections get finished in July is for the benefit of the visiting buyer. Just how most of the designers react to pressure, I don't know, but Nicole Groulx gave me one reaction. Her business may not have been large, her bills may not even have been paid, but I am sure what she told me would have been the same if she had been Chanel herself. After the collection was finished and shown to the buyers, who didn't come in any number nor buy in quantity, I decided something should be done. I reviewed the situation and went to Madame Groulx with a number of suggestions. She listened politely. The models were badly sewed up. They didn't fit the girls they were made on. The salespeople were phlegmatic. Nobody ever heard of her house. Why not do this and that, and she might have quite a good business? Madame Groulx looked me quietly in the eye and said, "I have diamond bracelets up to here," indicating her elbow. "Would I be any happier if I had them to my shoulder? I'm going to the Riviera tomorrow for a rest." Madame Groulx basically said, "Do I look like it's a problem for me, baby? I'm going to Riviera tomorrow. I'm rich." The French designers have fun. They are intelligent, artistic, wide-awake people. They are trained to make beautiful clothes for beautiful women. They do it according to the old traditional methods of designing and dressmaking for a wealthy clientele. Long may they wave. So all was fun and games prior to the Great Depression. This is something that she also describes, the effect that Great Depression had on the fashion industry. So basically, if your collections flopped, you were going to do poorly financially, obviously. The couturiers of France have help, in bad years and in good, from the fabric manufacturers. The French couturiers are virtually owned by the fabric manufacturers. Getting control financially of a dressmaking establishment is quite easy for a fabric manufacturer. Dressmakers, to all intents and purposes, are never paid by their private clients. Dressmakers need an enormous amount of credit from the manufacturers from whom they buy. There's probably not a couturier in existence who could not be closed up by some fabric manufacturer if the manufacturer just saw fit to collect what is owed him at the moment. The French fabric manufacturers don't care to close up the couturiers. On the contrary, they keep them going. The Paris couturiers are the display windows for French fabrics. For every good model of a given fabric designed and made by a top designer, the fabric house will sell many times the model's value in yardage. They sell the material not only through the designer's house, but through the other houses who copy the model in Paris, England, South America, the world. So am I right to understand that the fabric manufacturers sold the material to the original fashion house that came up with the design, and then to all of the houses around the world that basically ripped off that design? I think so. The French fabric manufacturer doesn't have to hire people to tell him what kind of fabrics to make. He works directly with the designers of clothes. He makes such and such for Vionnet, something else for Molinet, another sort of thing for Schiaparelli. Of course, he keeps Vionnet in business. She may make money in her house 1 year, lose it the next, but as long as she retains her following of private chic women, she will be kept going. And what if Vionnet makes a baddish collection 1 year? She is kept going because everyone knows that any designer has an off-season now and then. But let her make 4 bad collections in a row. Fini. Collect the bills. Goodbye, Vionnet. Give the credit to a new one. Build her up. What does Vionnet get out of this? She gets a salary with leeway. What did Patou get? He got his gambling debts paid when he was very successful. There came a year when the rumor floated up to Paris from the Riviera that they'd let Patou be put in jail because he couldn't pay his gambling debts. The fabric manufacturers had gotten a bit weary of gambling, and anyway, Patou wasn't having such a success. Pull yourself together, Mr. Patou, or we'll collect your bills. Paul Poiret turned out the designs once. He swept over Europe. He was the rage. He had everything he wanted. 15 years later, he was borrowing 10 francs from old acquaintances in the Café de la Paix. He couldn't turn it out anymore. Well, Poiret had his fun and Patou had his. Vionnet will be thrown out one day, but it's all a chance one is glad to take if one has an irresistible desire to dress people. That's an interesting point about some designers just not making it through time, because the influence of Paul Poiret on modern fashion is truly difficult to even put into words. And yet, his fashion house didn't last long. She's writing this in 1938. He was already done for. She mentions Patou is way past his prime. She mentions Vionnet might one day also be not a fashionable fashion house, which is true. Sometimes brands would desperately attempt to revive the name of the fashion house, but modern Vionnet is not even relevant in any way. No offense. When you order a bolt of material from France in 1937, you never know whether you're going to get it. The patient weavers of Lyon have decided it is no longer going to be cheaper for the fabric manufacturers to keep them at their hand looms. They are going to be paid, or the word of chic can go without its fine fabrics. It was all there to be seen in 1928, even that depression which has proved the instability of all legends. Hitler was planning right then to tell the Germans they didn't need French clothes or materials or anything which wasn't German. Mussolini was already beginning to convince the Italians that they should be Italian. If the old Roman fabrics were good enough for Caesar, they are good enough for you. Various South American countries were getting into that economic jam, which resulted in banning the export of their money. No more rich South American buyers for Paris. England was only a few years from the Buy British campaign. There are plenty of good clothes designers in London. I find it to be such a fascinating point about the impact nationalism rising in Europe in 1930s had on the fashion industry. Because it's definitely true that with the rise of homemade goods, the French designers were not that influential anymore. And some countries even implemented laws that were preventing people from importing or buying foreign goods. To sum up, here is how she ends the book. But whatever relation I, Elizabeth Hawes the couturier, bear to life in America, I am really quite a happy girl. I attribute it all to the fact that although I am engaged in the clothing business in America, where legends still flourish, where the public worries over whether its skirt is the prescribed length, and the manufacturer worries about how full the skirt is to be, where fashion is God, I have fun because I am in business for my health, and what is more, I say, fashion is spinach. I know that some members of my trade agree with me, and perhaps ultimately a majority of them may arrive at some such conclusion. Fashion may perish one day at the hands of its creators and promoters. If it doesn't pass out of existence in that way, I have a very firm belief something else will transpire. The American woman has been laboring under an excessive fashion for only a few decades. By and large, she has shown herself able to cope with the exigencies of life as the need has arisen. When she felt the time had come to vote, she saw to it that she was permitted. Eventually, she will look inside fashion's bright cellophane wrapper before she buys the contents. She will seriously consider the quality and the usefulness of the very newest thing, the epitome of all chic, the weight of all glamour. She will settle comfortably back in an old sweater and skirt and idly remark to 90% of what she sees, "I say to hell with it." I am sorry to say that Elizabeth Hawes so far has been mistaken, because if there is anything to be said about the American woman and the woman in general considering the quality and usefulness of clothes and deciding to drop out of the rat race that is following fashion, I think it's gotten a little worse. With the rise of fast fashion, I don't think it's safe to say that we are more considerate now when it comes to choosing what we wear. I feel like in some ways it's gotten worse. In some ways, obviously, we are more environmentally aware of what is happening, and maybe that's the aspect of it that Elizabeth Hawes have not really dreamed about. But in terms of fashion's influence sort of dying out, I feel like it's worse than ever. I feel like we judge people based on what they wear, same as we always have. I feel like we tend to think that we need more and more clothes, even more than we used to. It's not a positive conclusion to come to at the end of this episode, but I'm just thinking she was mistaken in terms of she just underrated the power of fashion industry, especially in a society like ours. So that's what I have to say. I don't know. I feel like my closet needs a purge now that I've said all this. But I think her book is a fascinating insight into the fashion industry in the 20s and 30s. So definitely read it if you have the time. And if you read the whole thing, do let me know what the hell she means by fashion is spinach, because I did not get there yet. Thanks for listening, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!